This came from an appeal by the retired Bishop of Tomboroyambio, Bishop Gassi. He came to Rome in 2004, I think, or early 2005. And he asked members of religious orders here in Rome, would they come to see the state of South Sudan after the end of the Second Civil War, after decades of civil war, really. And that appeal came to the unions of superiors general, men and women. There are two of these unions. And they decided to send a delegation to South Sudan in March 2006. And I was one of the people who went on that delegation to see the state of the country after so many years of war.
You were deeply shocked by what you saw, weren't you?
I was deeply shocked and deeply moved because when you sit for over a month in villages and towns, under trees, wherever you meet people, and you listen to stories and you listen to truth-telling from every quarter in society. I remember a young man saying to me, you know, I've been taught how to make war. Will somebody come and teach me how to make peace? I heard the anger of women who felt that their menfolk hadn't been protective of them. They had been raped and their villages had been burnt. They'd been pillaging. You heard about long years running in the bush from various militia groups, years spent in camps for internally displaced people or over the borders. One of the frightening statistics was that everybody in South Sudan had been displaced at least once, and some people would tell you stories of being displaced not once or twice or three times, but many times. I remember somebody saying we were branded like cattle. In some camp, in some kind of type of concentration camp they had been held. So the stories and the suffering was horrific, but the people were just so grateful that now the world was beginning to hear their story, hear that 2 million nearly had been killed and many million had been displaced. And that was only in 2006, when you think of it. I've often said to people I considered myself well-read and informed internationally, but I had never heard of South Sudan. I'd never heard, wasn't aware of the struggle. So you began to realise that if the media don't pick up on parts of the world where there's slaughter and war and conflict happening, then it can pass by. And that's the challenge, I think, to all of us, to focus on areas and maybe areas off the map, because, you see, it was very difficult to get to South Sudan. You had to either come up from Nairobi or down from Khartoum. And both, it was only the very brave managed that journey. And a lot of the people, in a sense, who were there were church people, different Christian groupings. But they were expelled by the northern government twice in the 60s and then again in the 80s. So the number of expatriate people who were there to know what was going on the ground were very few.
5 years on, your organisation, Solidarity with Southern Sudan, has managed to achieve an extraordinary amount, hasn't it, given all the difficulties that you faced?
It has, and I think that shows you the strength of collaboration. I mean, there are over 170 religious congregations contributing in some way to this initiative. We've been able to form partnerships with funders, sometimes governments, donor agencies. We're also partnering with peacekeeping organisations, with networks who are advocating for peace and development. We also make contact with people who pray. I mean, many of our members are in our congregations. You have many elderly sisters, priests and brothers who really do make Southern Sudan and the whole of Sudan the object of their prayer. And I think that kind of collaborative force, we underestimated. We've been able, you can look at the statistics and say, isn't it wonderful? We're training over 1,000 teachers. We've built 2 teacher training colleges, which are just about to open and train new teachers. We have renovated a huge health training centre in Wau, and we're training the first state registered nurses there, and we'll soon begin to train midwives there. We've lots of pastoral programmes for women and youth and so forth. But I look at all that and I'm amazed. We've only 25 people on the ground, and yet this is what we've achieved collaboratively. But I'm also amazed at the generosity of the South Sudanese, the welcome, the collaboration they've given. We're trying to do it together. doing it with the local church, doing it with the Sudanese on the ground who are in various organisations, church organisations or governments or the local chiefs or whoever. I mean, this is a partnership at many different levels. And I think that's its beauty. And also, we're not going... The tradition way a religious order would have gone would have, you'd go and you'd go to set up a community in a school or a clinic and be there for hundreds of years, maybe. We're going to finish. In other words, we know this project will last about 15 to 20 years. And by that time, we hopefully will have trained local people to take over and run all these programs and projects. And it's theirs. In fact, they're already theirs. It's just the capacity isn't there to take them over at this stage. We're doing it on behalf of the local people, the local church.
You're helping these people as they start a new chapter of their journey, if you like. After so many decades of war, they're now looking at a new nation. The needs are absolutely enormous, aren't they?
When people say, what do you need in Sudan? I just say everything and everybody. Anybody who can come, anybody who can give whatever you can, or from wherever, your support, your interest, your encouragement. Your encouragement, too, of South Sudanese who are living in different parts of the world. Encourage them to come home and help build a new nation. Because literally, there's almost nothing there in terms of infrastructure. Like in 2005, I often use the figure, South Sudan is the size of France and Germany combined. There was only, I think, 70 kilometres of paved road. So roads have had to be built. And the United Nations and the international community has played a big role in trying to develop the infrastructure, but schools, clinics, hospitals, everything. That whole infrastructure that we take for granted in other countries, you know, the existing teachers, only 7% have had any training whatsoever, and they need 26,000 new teachers. Again, one nurse for every 20,000. In the hospital in Wau, there are 204 nurses, of whom 4 are trained. One surgeon for every 300,000. Like, the needs are enormous. Yet the people just say, we want clean water, we want food, agriculture, we want food sustainability, we want a school for our children, and we want a clinic to go for. Their needs are kind of the very basic needs that you want to give for shelter and water and healthcare. And I suppose I appeal to everybody, the organisations, but also individuals. You know, our small donations can make a huge difference in a place like Sudan.
This is a nation, or these are people who have been living on handouts, on charity for decades, haven't they? Yet you're trying to instill, you're trying to build a new sense of nationhood, a new sense of self-reliance.
Yeah. Like one of the things, we're training nurses, just to give you an example in Wau, and I say to them, yes, you could get very well trained here and then go to Kenya and Uganda and earn big salaries, but we're pleading with you, go back to your villages. Help your people who have nothing. So you're having to build with the young people, particularly that you're training, a sense of obligation to the nation. I learned that in my own life because my parents were working for the government in a new Ireland when Ireland became independent. And I, at a young age, I learned what a sense of social responsibility to building a new nation, what it looks like. And it's a big challenge, and many won't be able for it because their daily needs are so acute. But there are many who will be able for it. And therefore, for young men and women, we're putting this challenge. The new nation needs you. Needs your skills, needs your competencies, needs your values, needs your commitment. Make this choice rather than a big salary. Because one of the things is we train people sometimes in some of our institutions and then they leave us and they go to the local NGO because there's a better wage. So you're trying to encourage people to make the kind of choices that are pro their country.
Another big question is that around peace building, reconciliation, conflict resolution between the many different tribal allegiances, as well as, of course, religious differences there too. And you're working on this, aren't you, as well?
We're working with others on that. And particularly, we're supporting the work of the Christian churches, who have played an enormous role in many peace conferences and peace initiatives in different parts, particularly of South Sudan, where they've brought tribes who have long histories of conflict. Often it's around land or water, the agriculturalists versus the pastoralists, or raiding, cattle raiding for bride price. And the Christian leaders have done wonderful work with the local traditional chiefs in developing processes of reconciliation, which involve local customs, local ways of peacemaking, as well as Christian ways of peacemaking.
For example?
They have a custom, say, for example, of slaughtering an animal, using the blood of an animal when you are making peace. And some of those, and particularly in some cases, I think it's a white bull that has to be slaughtered. So the Christian churches will use those local traditional rituals, but also build prayer, build testimony, build statements of regret. I mean, I've seen the texts of some of these where the local people will admit their wrongdoing. More recently, when we had a campaign called 101 Days of Prayer for a Peaceful Referendum in Sudan, we witnessed in Wau a wonderful ceremony where people of different tribes and different religious groups came together. And they had a wonderful ritual in the central square, in Freedom Square. And they were all asked to write on a piece of paper ways in which, first of all, they had offended their neighbour and where they were asking for forgiveness. And then to write also ways in which they had felt offended and oppressed. And these were burnt symbolically, so that you were trying to cleanse yourself of what evil does, both the evil that you do or we do to one another and the evil that's done to us. I mean, that can be a crippling force. And obviously, as Christians, we regard it as a grace to be able to do that. It's almost the divine power and the divine work of God in helping us to take that step, A, to ask for forgiveness, and B, to give forgiveness. Because any of the spiritual writers will tell us it's only the victim can actually take that step, that enormous step of both forgiving the other, forgiving the person who has done the wrong. And in that act, both are freed in a new way.
You're talking about the enormous role of the Christian churches there in the south. Of course, over the decades, there have been conflicts, Muslim-Christian conflicts, of course, with the northern government being a largely Muslim population. Is this still a critical problem or not?
Well, in a sense, I think it's a bit like other parts of the world where religion is used politically. The differences are exploited, any differences, and therefore one of the differences is the Christian-Muslim division. I mean, it remains to be seen what will happen to the north. And will it become, how will the North develop its own constitution when it becomes separate, when North and South separate, and also the role of religion in the Northern state. In the South, it's interesting, they almost want a non-religious state. They're almost making the other mistake of excluding religion because they've seen the effects of religion. So, for example, the Christian leaders were not included in the framing of the new constitution. Now, I think it's an interim document, but it was, I think, a mistake. You need to allow all the parties, including the religious voices, to participate. But they're being so careful because they've seen how religion was used to manipulate people. However, on the ground, the relations between Christians, Muslims, animists, others, is actually the relationship of neighbours, of people too who are surviving and who often are exploited by different groups. But during the lead up to the referendum, there was a big group in the south of Muslims for separation. So it was to show that you can't easily categorise. It's too easy to put people in categories and to stereotype people. And I think that's one of our challenges in today's world, that we don't say, well, we see Christian, it means X, and Muslim, and it means Y. That's too simplistic. We're basically all people. We've a religious tradition that's important, and it's a heritage, and it's part of what makes us who we are, part of our identity, an important part of identity. But that respect for the different identities. Like down in Juba, you have the call to prayer from several mosques. So that's a very healthy sign. The Christians and Muslims living alongside each other.
What are the hopes, the expectations, you think, as people look forward to Independence Day on July 9th?
I think you'll hear people talk about freedom. The sense of, I think that this new state gives them an identity of their own. I think the African in the state, in the country of Sudan, didn't feel that he or she was a respected person. They felt it was mainly, might I say, yes, an Arab country in which, yes, they were there, but they weren't citizens with the same rank and status as the Arab section of the population. And I think this will give people a new sense, a deep sense of their dignity as human beings and of their, and an opportunity to realise their potential. Now, I do think, I mean, like all new things, it has its own challenges. Some people, I'm sure, expect that things will improve overnight. Doesn't happen that way. It's a long journey. Some people maybe will be attracted by maybe a much more materialistic agenda. But I have a great belief when you see both the pride and the confidence of the Sudanese in their culture, in their languages. For example, I know a young man who speaks 17 languages. You know, I think we, in different parts of the world, we think we're accomplished. But you know, there is great depth and great talent. And there's a great desire to build a country where men and women feel equal, have the opportunities they want, the simple opportunities to live in peace and harmony, and also with enough resources to have a good life for themselves and their family.